Now, beloved listeners, you've seen images of soup being tossed at major artworks, activists gluing themselves to roads and buildings outside major fossil fuel companies, and other acts designed to sabotage those who are continuing to pollute our planet. Now, these are often the result of a group who called themselves the Extinction Rebellion, and they're known colloquially as XR. And they're a global environmental movement with the stated aim of using non-violent civil disobedience to compel governments to act urgently on the climate crisis. But one of XR's founders now says the movement has failed to gain a broad based consensus on how to meaningfully respond to the unfolding disaster. Enter stage left, Rupert Reed. Rupert is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of East Anglia, and his past books include This Civilization is Finished, Conversations on the End of Empire and What Lies Beyond. And Rupert joins me from his home in Norfolk to talk about why he has launched a new initiative called the Climate Majority Project and his book of the same name. Rupert, congratulations on your efforts and welcome to the Little Wireless Program.
Thank you, Phil. It's great to be here.
Rupert, could you start by telling us why you started Extinction Rebellion in the first place?
Yes, so I'd been thinking for some years that we were in terrible trouble and saying so, but we're talking back now in 2017, 2018, I didn't have a plan. And when I heard about Extinction Rebellion, I thought, oh, wow, these people get it as well. They're feeling it, where we're really at. But they have a plan. And so I went all in and helped launch XR and became one of its main strategists and spokespeople. And, you know, it was a great time. And we really succeeded in making a real difference to the national and the international conversation. Extinction Rebellion forced a change in climate consciousness in the UK and to some extent around the world, certainly including in Australia. But, you know, you can't carry on doing the same thing forever. In 2020, so this is now nearly 2 years after the launch of XR, like a number of other present or former rebels, I decided that it was time to shift to an approach which was going to succeed in bringing more people in. Because the thing about XR is that as it went on, it didn't bring more people in. It started bringing less people in eventually.
Well, let's remind the listener that XR's founders, you and your colleagues, set a target of mobilising 3.5% of the UK population, which is, what, 2 million? And it got nowhere near that target, didn't it?
That's absolutely right, yeah. And that's one quite stark way of putting the matter. Others include that XR started to become unpopular in the opinion polls. And, well, it became clear to me that it had basically achieved most of what it was capable of achieving. And what we needed to do now was to effectually appeal to, well, not just the 3.5%. The sociological and historical evidence suggests that actually you need a minimum of at least 25% in order to actually succeed in bringing about transformative change. And that is, you know, millions upon millions of people. Why 25%? By the way, I have a little theory about that. I think it's because when you get to 25%, people can maybe sense that you've got a majority of a majority. You understand me? You're halfway to getting an actual majority. So it seems like it's a kind of important tipping point. Anyway, be that as it may, the point is that I noticed that a lot of people who had been in XR were forming initiatives which were designed to appeal much more widely, designed to help mainstream the climate movement, designed to depolarize rather than polarizing further. I'm talking about initiatives such as the climate hubs that started springing up around this country and to some extent abroad. I'm talking about an organization called Lawyers for Net Zero, which organizes senior corporate lawyers to take climate action, not your usual suspects. I'm talking on the other end of the scale, if you will, about community climate action, which is people working in rural areas with often conservative local residents to get them organized to build resilience and to take effectual climate action of various kinds. And so we decided to create what's become the Climate Majority Project, to seek to network these people, to name what was emerging, to help thought lead the phenomenon, to help support what was coming. So we seed fund, we incubate especially promising organizations in the space to help them attain their full power. And there's something really exciting and encouraging about this, Phil, when you start to realize that you're part of something. I talk about it now as a wave of action, a huge wave of action that is distributed among these organizations and many, many others, which is starting to mobilize what will eventually be this 25% or more.
I've been banging away on this topic for 50 years, since the good old days of the greenhouse effect, for heaven's sake. And but we've had a series of governments in this country who were absolutely ardent denialists. Nonetheless, over 70% of Australians say they're concerned about climate change and its impacts. But so why is there this gap between awareness and taking action?
Well, as an outsider, if I may, I'll start with a word of observation about Australian climate politics. You have had an absolutely awful set of politicians and, of course, an absolutely awful print media, which has helped make that situation be perpetuated. I do take some encouragement from your recent general election, from the growth in the Greens, who are, you know, telling it like it is, and also, of course, from the Teal independence, which is exactly the kind of phenomenon that we are trying to encourage, if you will, in the Climate Majority Project. But to come to your question directly, the way we think about this is through our theory of change, which people can see on our website, climatemajorityproject.com, if they want in detail. And it's well worth looking into, or in our book, The Climate Majority Project. But to outline very, very briefly, what we think is that this sense that I was describing a minute ago of collective awareness, emerging collective awareness of what's happening and of being part of something larger, of not being alone in this endeavor to turn the tide on climate decline, is absolutely critical. And what goes along with that is, again, a more or less collective endeavor to handle the very difficult truth about where we are. It's not enough for people just to hear the truth. They have to be helped to process it, because it's so bloody awful, the truth of our planetary predicament. People need assistance, and that can go all the way up to peer groups and psychotherapy and so forth, to cope with the truth, the traumatic truth about where we're at. But when people get that help, when people get that assistance in handling the difficult truth, then that strengthens this sense of collective awareness and starts to build this wave.
There used to be a term known as compassion fatigue. There's also, of course, climate fatigue, with people feeling hopeless, overwhelmed, apathetic. These are all factors, aren't they?
Absolutely. And of course, it's crucial to remember this is a marathon, not a sprint. This is going to go on and on. This is not a problem that's going to be solved. This is a new condition that we are all part of. It's a tragic condition, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do about it. There is always plenty that we can do about it. If people have this sense that others are already doing stuff about it, and this sense that they're not alone in handling also the difficult truth, then they can take more of the truth. They can deepen their understanding of the facts of the matter. And if they're offered then intelligible ways in which they can take action, pathways to agency, then action becomes something natural and spontaneous. This gap that you spoke about between one's attitude or one's beliefs on the one hand and action on the other hand, that just disappears, because when one understands that one is part of something larger, that is inevitable, that is growing, that is in response to the truth, and that that difficult truth can be handled and appreciated more deeply, then the natural thing to do is to act in the powerful and effective ways that people can act. As I say, that has all sorts of diverse forms. It depends on who you are and what your capabilities are. But there is something significant. I believe that everyone has a power, indeed a superpower, in relation to this. For some people, it's about networking. For other people, it's simply putting their money behind the cause. For other people, it will be acting through their in their professional capacity as lawyers, as insurers, as teachers. There are numerous ways, but there is a way for everybody to be part of this wave. And that is a really encouraging thought in this dark and difficult time.
I chaired a government outfit called the Commission for the Future half a century ago, and this was our absolute main focus. And then it was called the greenhouse effect. Then it morphed into global warming. It's escalated then to climate change, to climate crisis, to climate emergency. Language is very important, isn't it?
Well, yes, and that's been part of my professional work over the last generation, thinking about this systemically. It is really important that we name accurately what the phenomenon is. So, for example, my recent book with Bloomsbury was called Why Climate Breakdown Matters. Now, Bloomsbury, the publishers, they wanted me to call it Why Climate Change Matters. And I said, no, if you talk about climate change, it makes it sound kind of basically pretty anodyne. What we're experiencing, and you know full well what I'm talking about here, coming from the Australian context, the horrendous disasters you've had in the last few years, what we're talking about here is not something even remotely anodyne. And remember, everybody, we are only at the beginning of this. It is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And it's that kind of, it's girding one's loins for that kind of epic lifetime struggle. This is about the entire purpose and meaning of all of our lives. That too, though, Phil, is an encouraging thought, because many people in this time, they say to me things like, well, I'm not really sure what life is for anymore. It all seems a bit pointless. I'm depressed about the situation, etc. There is here a huge opportunity to find meaning and purpose in one's life. And the kind of anomie and depression that you were mentioning yourself a minute ago, Phil, that can actually be processed and turned into something very different, turned into the kind of energy that we need to undertake this immense struggle, this meaning-giving struggle together, which is what is going to happen. And as things get worse before they get better, then we will go deeper into this maelstrom, deeper into the abyss. And in that abyss, I believe we will find ourselves, and we will find our absolute determination to make some kind of future.
You make the point that the current movement only tends to offer people two choices when it comes to action, either something radical or changing their behaviour as consumers.
Yes, and this is an inadequate binary, right? There's a whole lot that's in the middle of that. It's between those two poles. And say, changing our consumer behaviour, etc., everybody knows that that is just nowhere near enough. It's never going to add up to enough to actually change our direction of travel. But for most people, soup throwing or gluing themselves to things is simply not an option for various reasons. So we are here for everybody who is looking for something meaningful that lies between those two poles. The Climate Majority Project is about saying, think about what the maximum is that you can do, probably entirely within the law, in your professional context or in your business or your institutional context, or where you live along with other people, or where you pray, wherever is the place in your life that you have the most potential leverage. And if you haven't figured out what that is yet, and especially perhaps if you're a younger person, you may not have figured that out yet, then spend some time figuring it out. Find that leverage and then use it to the maximum. If we are going to get through this, we're going to get through it together. So not just as isolated consumers, nor even as isolated voters. We're going to get through this together, but that doesn't mean you have to engage in radical tactics. What it means is you have to be absolutely serious in devoting yourself to playing your part in the great change that is coming.
Now, we recall vividly the great Aldermaston marches, the marches against the Vietnam War, the marches that tried to prevent the invasion of Iraq, and of course the immense marches that that augmented the civil rights movement. This doesn't seem to be the way it's working now.
Yeah, so look at the school climate strikes, for instance, which were really tremendously huge. They're on the finest day of those marches around the world. They reckon they had over 12 million young people, school children, etc., marching. Did they have any success? Well, yes and no. They didn't succeed in changing policy, except in one or two isolated instances. They did succeed in contributing to this uprising of consciousness that I described earlier, such that we are in a transformed situation now to some extent compared to how we were in, say, 2018 when XR and Greta first got going. But yes, I think it is clear to many people that in terms especially of the kind of transformational change that is necessary in relation to climate, we're talking about a massive change, not only in our energy systems, but in our food systems, in our transport systems, in nearly everything about the way that we live, a change that we have to undertake together. So there is no way of doing this without most people being on side. When we can't just really be talking about marches or, for that matter, nonviolent direct action. We have to be talking about systematic transformation in our politics, but probably before that, in our lives as we live them together. So I'm talking about people getting active in their local communities to build resilience in their local communities, to try to build water storage capacity, emergency response capacity, food growing capacity, to build community in ways that are increasingly necessary. And I'm talking about changes, as mentioned before, in our workplaces, especially if you're in one of those many professions which has some kind of special leverage here: insurance, audit, banking, finance, teaching, journalism, Phil. These are the kinds of professions that perhaps have an especially obvious way in which they can make a huge difference if people in those professions get organized, in those kind of business and financial contexts, get organized to determine and to press for the kind of changes that we needed. The greatest power of business and finance, we believe at this time, is the power to say to governments, look, we don't just want you anymore to provide a nice business environment for us and reduce the so-called regulatory burden and so forth. No, we want you to create a higher level playing field for everybody. We want you to drive out bad actors. We can't actually succeed in doing the right thing on climate and nature unless we get the rules set right. So business and finance need to be pressing for politicians to do something better rather than to do something worse.
It's a banal observation, but I have observed recently that climate change has dropped down the hit parade with the young because they're so damn worried about the cost of living and here the housing crisis. So how do you engage people in the struggle when they're just trying to make ends meet?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are some good answers available to it, though. So one crucial answer is that there are real win-wins here. An obvious one is insulation, retrofit. If we make our buildings fit for purpose, then we need a lot less to heat them and a lot less power to air condition them too. And that is just an absolute no-brainer. It is. I'm not really sure about how the situation is on this front in Australia, but in Britain, it's absolutely dire. A third of houses in this country have no insulation in their roofs at all, which is truly unbelievable. It's mainly because landlords have no incentive to put insulation into the houses that they, the buildings that they rent out. So if we get serious, and hopefully the next government with pressure from the likes of us will get serious about a massive insulation and retrofit program, then it really helps from the climate perspective and from the energy perspective, and it makes us less dependent on oil states such as the Middle Eastern states and Russia. And of course, it contributes massively to reducing cost of living. So there are those kind of absolute no-brainer win-wins. Beyond that, I would say also that it's crucial to try to help people, especially those people who are in a position to make these kinds of judgments, to think a little bit longer term. So I'm talking here especially about people who are better off and elites and so forth. It just won't do for us to always be dashing from one immediate crisis to the next. We have to be willing to raise our heads periodically and look up at the enormous wave that is bearing down on us, the wave of climate destruction. And our wave of action has to rise up to meet it. If we, the longer we leave taking action on these matters, we know the worse the crisis will become. As you were saying, Phil, we've left it way too long in our lifetimes already. It's essential to move now. And governments such as the ones we have right now in the UK, and for that matter in Australia, are far, far off the pace with this. So I would say to young people listening, for instance, I totally understand if you are thinking, God, I can't really focus on this because I've got so many more immediate preoccupations. I would say, firstly, try to press those who have the capacity to have longer term preoccupations to exercise that capacity. And secondly, as I said, look for those kind of win-wins, because they absolutely do exist. If we take the right kind of action on climate and nature, we will make our lives better and we will make our wallets better too.
Now, there's a paradox here. I mentioned that 70% of Australians are concerned about climate change, and heavens above, they can't all be lefties. So that means that climate concern does cross the political divide, despite the best efforts of the right-wing parties around the world to change the subject.
That's absolutely right. I think that's what the teal independence, the climate independence in Australia showed very well. And the observation you've just made is absolutely integral to the DNA of the Climate Majority Project. So when we got started in the UK, and we're mainly trying to prove concept in the UK at the moment, but we're already liaising with people around the world, because obviously eventually this needs to become a worldwide phenomenon. And stuff like this is, of course, happening already in some respects in places like Australia. When we launched the Climate Majority Project in the UK, we quite deliberately involved some conservative politicians who get this question. And of course, they do exist, and they need to be praised and they need to be supported. The Climate Majority does not know political boundaries. It has no ideology as such. The Climate Majority is a phenomenon which is based, if you will, really in common sense. It's common sense. It's just looking at the facts, being willing to open one's eyes to understand that we're in real trouble and we need to pull together to get through this trouble. An analogy I like to give is with Britain in the Second World War, where famously you had a national government that was led, in fact, by a Conservative Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, that instituted very bold transformational policies in response to the emergency that they were then suffering. For example, food rationing, which, you know, you might imagine Conservatives would have denounced as a sort of socialist plot. But of course, people got behind food rationing because they realized it was necessary for survival. And that's the kind of mindset that we need to start to enter into. What is necessary for our common survival? What is necessary for our common flourishing? And when you start asking questions like that, then it's obvious that people can get together in a non-polarized way across the political spectrum in order to do what's necessary here. And that is what is going to happen. That is what has to happen.
Going back to direct action tactics such as that of XR, the hope is that the government, the authorities, will eventually yield to pressure. But as you point out, we shouldn't put our faith in government.
Yeah. So we have to take leadership where governments have failed to take leadership. So that means, for instance, as I was saying a few minutes ago, engaging systematically in local resilience building. Because, you know, no one is coming to save us. There is no cavalry. The kinds of disasters that we've experienced so far, especially you folks in Australia, these are only the beginning. They are harbingers. We need to organize now to deal with those and not wait for others, not outsource to others the responsibility for dealing with them. Having said that, it is also, of course, essential that government does step up more. So that's why another aspect of the Climate Majority Project is to find genuinely effective ways of leveraging change from the government. That's what we think a key role is, as I say, for business and finance, to turn from being villains of the peace to being potentially heroes, especially, for example, people like insurers. So we're seeing around the world, and I know this is starting to happen in Australia, it's really kicked off in California and Florida. We're seeing around the world insurers pulling back from insuring people. So insurance is letting people down systematically. Insurers need to step up, but of course, there's a sense in which the insurer of last resort is the government. Huge pressure has to be put on the government to actually do the right thing by its people. And when you start to think about this systematically, then it becomes common sense for insurers to require resilience building on the part of those that they insure, for insurers to pressure government to change its policies, and for government to start to think, how do we avoid a situation where we actually can't afford to bail people out when an emergency hits? Well, ultimately, the way we do that is by stopping there from being so many disasters. So it all kind of adds up and makes a certain amount of sense. We can't wait for government, but we all also know that there won't be enough action to actually turn the whole tide unless we force the governments to turn themselves into something better as well. And that is possible. It's happened before.
Rupert Reid, I want you to tell me about Joseph Overton and his, tell me about the Overton window.
Yeah, so Mr. Overton was not someone who I would agree with on all political matters, but he did have this one very splendid idea, which is one needs sometimes to change not just what the policy is within a sort of agreed, understood agenda of what's politically possible. One has to change people's sense of what's politically possible. And hopefully listeners can already hear the potential relevance of that to what we're talking about here. Stuff which seems beyond the realms of possibility has to be made to feel possible. And that is now called changing or moving the Overton window, bringing things into the window of possibility that seem to be outside it. And what might that be in relation to our future? Well, one kind of grand vision of this is going beyond the idea of economic growth as the be-all and end-all of government policy. As long as we're chasing endless economic growth, then we're never going to take ecology, nature, and the climate seriously enough. Jacinda Ardern's government in New Zealand made some useful gestures in the direction of moving beyond an obsession with growthism. It is possible. On a more sort of humdrum level, it would be thinking about a radical relocalization. We're used to thinking about our world as a globalized world with endlessly growing travel and communications. But actually that is going to stop, and that is going to go into reverse in some significant respects, because you simply cannot have a world in which there are more and more jets, including private jets, etc., forever. There is no way that is possible. Sooner or later, if you try to have such a world, you will endure a horrendous climate collapse, which will look much, much worse than what we've had so far. So the Overton window shift in this case would be, what if we were to think about a future in which most of what we eat and do and buy and so forth all happened within a relatively local area? That is an idea which is not really in any political manifesto of a party at the moment, but I think within a decade it will be.
There was a movement called Transition Towns in the UK, where whole communities worked together to take action on a local level. And here in Oz, we did a program on one in Yakadanda in Victoria. What happened to theirs?
Well, so the Transition Towns movement still exists and does some good stuff. Why did it not grow further and faster and wider and last more strongly? I would single out two main reasons. Firstly, I think maybe it came a little bit soon. I think we're now at the point where millions upon millions of people are ready to get involved in things like this. And that is why we're quite hopeful that the Climate Majority Project may be an idea whose time has come. And secondly, there was sometimes a kind of perception that the transition movement was for people who were kind of grow your own types or hippies or lefties or progressive activists. I think this was an unfair perception, but it was quite a widespread perception. Now, that's again why in the Climate Majority Project, we are absolutely deliberately, again, a little bit like the Teal Independence, trying to buck that perception and to make clear, no, this is for conservatives as well, if they are actually serious, as some are increasingly, about confronting the climate crisis. This is for business people. This is for ordinary families, parents, children, etc. This is basically for everyone. This is for everyone who is not in denial. This is for everyone and anyone who is willing to step into the kind of space we talked about earlier, a space of being willing to face the awful truth, to feel it, to look for and search determinedly for the best, most effective ways, along with others, that they can act on it, and to understand that this phenomenon is growing and spreading and is bound to be fueled by the weather, tragically, which is our greatest recruiter. And when one starts to understand all of this, then one understands very clearly that this cannot be the preserve of any one narrow demographic. It has to be about people who are not just progressive activists, but go way beyond that. And I think that kind of perception and that kind of movement building or wave building or action taking is now possible. It is starting to emerge.
I can't let you go without asking you a rather odd question. When you're not running climate action campaigns, you're an associate professor of philosophy at the University of East Anglia and a particular fan of Wittgenstein. How does this play into your approach to tackle the climate crisis?
Well, firstly, a small correction, Phil. I'm actually now an emeritus philosophy professor. And what emeritus means, it's a fancy word for retired. I stepped down.
I'm about to be an emeritus broadcaster, so I'm...
Yeah, exactly. I stepped down from my actual paid role as an academic last summer to really focus on the Climate Majority Project. But my philosophy still, I think, very much informs what I try to do. I could give you a very long answer. We could have a whole program on Wittgenstein and the climate crisis. But I would single out one thing, which is that Wittgenstein was a great critic of the concept, the assumption of progress. He thought that the idea of progress often was a shield behind which dreadful things were hidden. Consider, for example, the phrase, you can't stop progress. People most often use that phrase when they're describing things actually getting worse, when they're describing some, say, road being built, which is going to devastate some ecosystem. And most people actually don't want the road to be built, but it's still going to be built anyway. Wittgenstein was a very acute critic of the way that the concept of progress can deform our thinking and lead us into normalizing activities such as endlessly trying to so-called grow the economy, endlessly trying to develop the landscape to death. Wittgenstein was a great critic of the way in which we have all those activities normalized under the heading of progress. So maybe what we're looking to actually is a world which in a certain sense is post-progress. Not that things can't carry on getting better, potentially in artistic terms or moral terms, we can become better people potentially. But no, the idea of endlessly growing our economy is endlessly developing, of there endlessly ever more being more and more industry, that is an idea that is killing us. Ultimately, we have to let go of that idea. And I think more and more people sense this.
I'm glad I asked. I've been talking to Emeritus Professor Rupert Reed, co-author and editor of The Climate Majority Project, setting the stage for a mainstream urgent climate movement, and it's published by London Publishing Partnership. Rupert, thank you very much for your time.
Phil, it's been a pleasure. Any time in your emeritus life.
We shall meet again.
Yeah.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.